Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, who's the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Caroline. And your organization, the American Constitution Society, is sort of the polar opposite of the Federalist Society. And there's a very interesting article in The New Yorker by Jeffrey Toobin, The Conservative Pipeline to the Supreme Court, that profiles the importance of Leonard Leo, who is the executive, who has been for some time the executive vice president of the Federalist Society. His name has come up in previous interviews I've done with Elizabeth Wider and other Supreme Court watchers about the idea of this phenomenon called Supreme Court shopping. But I had no idea, and I'm sure the public don't realize, that Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society have basically put John Roberts, Sam Alito, and now Gorsuch onto the court.
That's right. And what's really troubling is that the way that President Trump ran his process was basically to say, I'm going to outsource this to an extreme right-wing organization. You tell me who the judges should be, and I want to make sure that I'm appointing judges who are going to meet the test of overturning Roe v. Wade and expanding access to guns in America. So the president had a litmus test, and he basically farmed out the selection to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation to tell him who his judges should be.
Well, in the hearing, in the confirmation hearing, Judge Gorsuch did say that he was first contacted by Leonard Leo, not the White House. So it's not exactly a secret. But I, a little while back, interviewed the lawyer for the so-called frozen truck driver who was put in an impossible situation where he either had to freeze to death or save his life and lose his job, which he did. Six of the seven judges that heard the case ruled in favor of the truck driver, but Neil Gorsuch ruled in favor of the corporation. And the attorney that I interviewed, who represented the so-called frozen truck driver, he felt that Neil Gorsuch was in fact auditioning for the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, that he was trying to attract their attention by being such a zealous corporatist in this extraordinary ruling against a man who, according to Neil Gorsuch's logic, should have died on the job for the sake of his corporation.
Absolutely, and I think that's a very fair point by the lawyer, because you know what the Judge Gorsuch did in that case was he went out of his way to claim that the text of the statute refuted the trucker's case, and he claimed this mantle of textualism, meaning I know we'd all like to be soft-hearted, but the fact of the matter is those of us, we're rigorous on the right, and we don't let anybody read anything into the text. In fact, he just read into the text the view that he wanted. And what I think is really disturbing is how originalism and textualism are really just masks for outcome-driven right-wing aspirations.
And what about this phenomenon of Supreme Court shopping, not just in terms of picking judges, but in also getting issues before the court, like Citizens United, which came out of a group of fairly obscure group of right-wing activists, and the D.C. Heller case, and they suddenly get fast-tracked. And who's behind that?
Well, so there are a number of those right-wing legal groups that work to advance cases when they think they have the right makeup on the court, that is, enough conservatives or extreme right-wing justices who will agree with their arguments. So it's the same with the attack on the Affordable Care Act and other areas where there is sort of outlandish theory that's advanced, and yet knowing that the justices on the court, knowing who they are and what they believe, the groups then move them through the court system and they get fast-tracked by the Supreme Court. Justice Alito did this in some ways with a case attacking the ability of unions to get fair share fees from those people who are not members of the union but get all the benefits of union membership. And Justice Alito, in a dissent a couple of years ago, indicated that, you know, he was ready to look at the precedents in that case that was over 40 years old that establishes the ability of working people to come together and join a union. And he sort of flagged this, saying, I think we can get this one taken care of the next go around. And so then they worked to bring this case called the Friedrichs case, which originated out of California. It didn't get resolved in the last Supreme Court term because there were only eight justices, and it was a tie. So they didn't end up reaching a decision. But unfortunately, that one's going to come back. But that's, you know, definitely the sort of the process that they work is to think about what are the issues that they want to address. You know, what are the cases they want overturned, or what's the new ruling that they want, and make sure they have the court in place that's going to agree with them.
And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. So the role then of the Federal Society appears to be to sort of create the farm team for conservative Supreme Court justices to groom them, identify them, and in this case, as we suggested, Neil Gorsuch sort of auditioned. He wasn't on the first list that was sent to the White House, but he made it to the second list, and it may well have been because his outrageous ruling on the frozen truck driver came to somebody's attention. But let's talk a little bit about Leonard Leo, who's profiled in Jeffrey Toobin's article in the New Yorker, the conservative pipeline to the Supreme Court. He had a daughter who was born with spina bifida. She died. He has six other children. Apparently, he's extremely very devout Catholic. And one of the children, one died, and then there's another child that also has a spina bifida. And he has made no secret of the fact that the so-called right to life issues is central to him. So they are determined, and he is determined, Leonard Leo, to overturn Roe v. Wade. There's just no ambiguity about that.
Absolutely no ambiguity. And, you know, and in fact, you know, what one of the well-known legal commentators, Ed Whalen, on the right, has said, you know, he said outright, basically, you know, if Leonard Leo is involved in the selection process, we know that any nominee is going to be ready to overturn Roe. We know that. We know that was the litmus test that President Trump laid out. Certainly, it's easy for now Justice Gorsuch to say that he wasn't asked by Donald Trump whether he was going to overturn Roe v. Wade because he'd already been asked by Leonard Leo. And they already knew, in any case, because of the judge's history, his rulings, his opinions on assisted suicide, but also his musings in the Hobby Lobby case, and in another associated case dealing with women's reproductive rights, where it's clear he's very, very hostile.
So what's wrong with the Democrats? They don't understand the importance of the Supreme Court as much as the Republicans do, because one of the things that's problematic is, since we live in such a divided country, that we sort of end up being in some kind of bubble, and we don't understand the other people in the Fox bubble, for example.
Yeah.
And they love what Trump is doing. He looks like the most outrageously reckless, dangerous, ill-equipped, ill-informed, and deeply embarrassing president that the United States has ever had, but 80 to 90% of the people out there that voted for him just think he's doing a great job, and they're thrilled with Gorsuch being on the court. So why is the right more interested in the Supreme Court than the left?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question and a very important one. And, you know, I think we have a lot to learn from what the right has done. I mean, one is I appreciate the fact that progressives really care passionately about issues. Their engagement and their energy is focused on issues like protecting the environment, education, health care, civil rights. But we pay less attention to the levers of power. So we don't focus as much attention on the rules. and the procedures by which decisions are made. Whereas on the right, they want power. They get excited about power, and so they want to control the mechanisms that give you power. So they work very hard to make it hard to vote. They make it very hard for people to get into the courtroom to exercise their rights if their rights have been violated. And they want to control who the judges are, because they know that if you have the judges on your side, you're going to win. And, you know, and I always think it's it was no irony, really, when Chief Justice Roberts was talking about being an umpire during his confirmation hearings. Because, honestly, if you have the umpires on your side, you win every single game. And so that's where I think one of the big differences, and one of the things we're trying to do at the American Constitution Society, is trying to get our the people who care about all those issues to recognize that they're never going to be successful unless they also really care about how policy is made, how the judges operate, who the judges are, whether you can get into a courtroom or not. Because if you can't, if you don't know what the rules are, or the rules are written so you can't get your rights recognized, then you've lost.
So do you believe then that given that Leo's already gotten Roberts on the court, Alito, and now he's got Gorsuch on the court, and they're all determined to overturn Roe v. Wade, so the next one on the farm team from the Federal Society will do it? And apparently William Pryor is even closer to the Federal Society than even Gorsuch is, and he's a very conservative judge who's been named in several of these go-rounds. And there's also Amul Thapar, who's a favourite of Mitch McConnell's. So what do you think is going to happen with the next one? Is it, they keep talking about the age of various justices there, but there's also the possibility that now that Gorsuch is on the court, that Anthony Kennedy, who's to some extent his mentor, can now retire.
Well, you know, it's something we're obviously very concerned about. I wish eternal life on Justice Ginsburg, as do all of us on the left. And, you know, she's healthy and hearty, so that's terrific. But, you know, I think there's going to be another battle. It's possible that it won't happen until after this first term and maybe only term of President Trump. And I think for most of us, that would be, you know, a strong preference. But, we don't control the lifespans or retirement wishes of Supreme Court justices. But, you know, I think this is the moment where I'm really hoping that that those of us who've been working on these issues and fighting these battles can find the broader progressive community and people across the spectrum who will join with us in recognizing that the courts are really an important element of our separation of powers. In our government cannot function if we have complete control by one party and by one ideology. And if that were to happen and the right becomes so firmly entrenched in the Supreme Court, democracy is so threatened. And so, you know, our work is going to be to try and get the broad groups that have been energized in opposition to President Trump, those who are frightened by what's happened since then, since his inauguration, to think about the idea that having him appoint a second justice, what that would mean for our country in the long term. It's very frightening. And I do think the tide is turning. I think progressives and people beyond the far right are recognizing that, you know, we really can't ignore the importance of the courts, and we have to invest just as much energy and commitment and passion to the judiciary as we do to the elected branches. So we'll see. But we are gearing up. If there's going to be a battle, we're going to fight it.
Well, but the first battle surely will be 2018, the midterm elections, and the indications from the special election that just took place in Kansas, where the Democrats did surprisingly well in a solidly Republican district, could indicate, well, surely you have to accept the premise, do you not, Caroline, that if you control the Senate and the White House, Mitch McConnell has set the precedent now. If you control the Senate and the White House, you can put anybody on the Supreme Court, and you can deny, as they did, Judge Garland, which was outrageous. I, for the life of me, do not understand how Gorsuch can look himself in the mirror and not recognize that he's in a stolen seat and not even feel bad about it. I mean, at the Rose Garden ceremony the other day, they all congratulated each other about how wonderful it was. Gorsuch reached out to McConnell and said what a great job he'd done, what a great job Grassley's done. These people really are ruthless.
No, that's true. But I think, you know, we've got to look to other tools. The Senate is not going to be a very effective bulwark for freedom, that's for sure. And so, you know, I think there are other ways, though. I think if the House returns to Democratic hands, there are a lot of ways of exercising authority indirectly through the variety of mechanisms of delay, obstruction, and oversight that I think they can bring to bear that, you know, are not directly tied to the confirmation battle of a justice, but can really upend the way it proceeds. And I think we, the people, have to be out in the streets. We have to protest. We have to be there to raise our voices and say, no, we are not going to see this country return to the time of back alley abortions. We're not going to let another justice be appointed who's going to expand money in politics, which has already drowned our system in excess of greed and allowed the wealthy to control our political branches. We can't let that happen. And we may not have a filibuster in the Senate anymore, but we do have a lot of power as the people, and we've got to exercise it.
Right, but the Citizens United decision that you just referred to, that was, of course, both the Chief Justice Roberts and Anthony Kennedy, and it seems to me that that was a part of a strategy, a political strategy. Not, you know, talk about judicial activism, as was overturning Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. They had direct impact on the Democratic opposition, and they made the permanently made the minority party, which is the Republican Party, they've given them a real leg up and an advantage. And it seems to me it just simply could not be considered some kind of accident. This looked like a deliberate strategy.
Oh, no question. And that's why I, you know, return to my argument that they care about power and issue rulings that control the mechanisms of power. Well, we spend a lot of time talking about issues. Nonetheless, I do think that there is a role for popular constitutionalism, that the people have had tremendous influence over time. If the Supreme Court is out of step with the public and the public rises up, we think about the New Deal and how out of step the Supreme Court was and leading President Roosevelt to threaten to pack the court. And then, you know, they began to reassess their rulings on those critical New Deal statutes. There are moments in our history where the public has been able to exercise its own understanding of the Constitution and correct the mistakes made by the Supreme Court. So, I do think there's a responsibility on all of us to work to make sure that the damage doesn't expand and that President Trump doesn't get a Supreme Court, you know, that's going to last for 40 years and dictate the future that comes from a position from the far right and is out of step with the vast majority of Americans.
Well, indeed. The other aspect, apart from the fact that they're going to try and overturn abortion, is that these people are all corporatists that we've been talking about. And in the hearings, they never really get into the corporatism. But it's clear that they're all zealous corporatists. And that, to me, it means that they could have a critical mass in terms of pro-corporatism, and frankly, corporatism is based upon the legal fiction that corporations are persons in law. So the real battle, to my mind, is between, and this is, by the way, I'm quoting William Jennings Bryan now, who at the end of the beginning of the 20th century, at the end of the 19th century, said that the greatest challenge in the next century, being the 20th century, is to protect the God-made man from the man-made God, the corporation. So real people have got to stand up against these fictional persons in law known as corporations.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And that's, you know, why I do think it is important to remember that, you know, we the people are the foundation of our democracy. Our Constitution is based on popular sovereignty. And the Supreme Court has to be subject to the popular understanding at some point when it gets so out of whack and out of touch, because the Constitution was meant to be a document that protects our democracy, not tears it down.
Well, Caroline Frederickson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on.
And again, I'll be speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's a president of the American Constitutional Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the organizer of the Los Angeles Tax March on Saturday that will feature a giant inflated chicken with a Trump hairstyle and a golden beacon claws that appropriately is made in China.